Okay, can I ask everyone to please take their seats? It's our final session with we are now going to begin. For those of you that were at the last session, one of the interesting conversations that we had was a halachic concern that Rav Eliashiv discussed, that was a person doing a code might not put his entire effort into it, and therefore, although halachically permissible in certain ways in terms of the organ issue, the code would be the issue. So, as it turns out, it's a perfect segue for Rabbi Dr. Weiss to discuss this emerging concept, which we see more in hospitals, which is referred to as a slow code. Dr. Weiss. Last comment, just if anybody did not still want to get a certificate, please let me know. Please see me immediately after the lecture. I'm giving them out, and I'm hoping that you in return will give me the evaluation forms of 3 pages. Thank you, and Dr. Weiss.
Thank you very much. Can think of no better way to end the conference than on a question whether we should resuscitate or not in terms of continuing. So I guess we will basically terminate the conference with this lecture. Please, any applause should be slow. Thank you. You can follow along in your handout. On page 183, it goes for a few pages. I have an article in there as well that I had the privilege of writing in a very nice journal that the students at Stern College for Women put together. Students at Stern College put out a number of journals. Derech HaTeva is one very fascinating journal under the auspices of Dr. Babich. In this particular journal, Science and Ethics, a Joint Perspective, I have the privilege of being the faculty advisor to that. So those are wonderful journals that the students put out. So I have an article in there from a few years back. All of you, I'm sure, have experienced, participated, observed resuscitative efforts, CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, as well as more advanced resuscitation as well. If not, then I'm sure you've seen it on ER or when I was growing up on St. Elsewhere. This is not a serious topic. This is just. But the truth is that it is a serious topic, and do not resuscitate or do resuscitate are very important issues, as was quite extensively discussed just previously. It's interesting, Rabbi Dr. Glatt was talking about certain default approaches, so it is interesting that of all the medical modalities, the one that does not require kind of pre-authorized consent is resuscitative efforts, meaning the default mode is that if a person, whether found in the field, in the home, or in a hospital, then there is no order not to resuscitate, then the default mode is to resuscitate. That actually, there's an article that I included in here written by a nurse, a very interesting case. I'm not going to go through it all. It's a very interesting article, worthwhile reading, just in terms of her own personal experiences with her grandfathers. That is in Viewpoints by M.C. Sullivan, where she recommends that the default mode should be changed. And as she concludes her article by saying it is time to do away with do not resuscitate orders and make resuscitation orders the norm. That isn't always practical and always possible, to be quite honest, as you may know clinically, but the concept is an interesting one. There's an article in there about that. And I recommend that you read it, just the vignettes that she talks about her grandparents itself. I think quite interesting and certainly worthwhile. I'm not going to get into that. But I'd like to discuss, just begin with a little bit about what this slow code is. So in the handout, you have a little bit of a description from a website about the slow code. There's also a very interesting website called laboratorium.net, laboratorium.net, where they talk about slow code. And there was an article several years ago in the New York Times, not so long ago, I think in 2008 or 2007, where the New York Times ran an article about a problem in general that exists not infrequently, where hospitals do not respond in a timely fashion to a code blue. So if a hospital has a code blue where a patient has arrested, heart is arrested, they're not breathing, and there is a need to resuscitate. That there has been apparently reported in some hospitals somewhere. I haven't read the article itself in the Times, but you can Google it and find it either from beginning of 2008 or end of 2007. Article about hospitals responding too slowly, just in general. Apparently, the recommendations are that there should be no more than 2 minutes from the time of arrest to the time of defibrillation, if that's the modality that's being used. And apparently, there was a longer lag time between the time. I remember as a resident once running up the stairs, because it's hard to take an elevator. Who knows how long it could take? So by the time I got there, I think I needed resuscitation. But nonetheless, and that's a question of lag time. It's interesting, they point out, that nighttime and weekends, tends to be, in some cases, a longer lag time because of the understaffing. And what's interesting as well is the fact that there apparently were some evidence that African Americans are responded to more slowly. The suggestion was made in this article. You can get it on Laboratorium. It is not included in your handouts, but if you look at laboratorium.net/archive/2008 and look up slow code, that they attributed to the quality of the hospitals in the regions in which commonly African Americans live, which is a demographic issue and a question about differentials and disparities between one hospital and another in the United States. That itself is a very important, fascinating, and perhaps a little bit of a disturbing fact. But then they talk about the issue of the slow code, where there is some, if you will, deliberate intent on being a little bit slower to respond, or in the process of resuscitating, there's a little bit of a less aggressiveness. So a slow code, which the article that includes for you uses different synonyms for slow code. It can either be like the light blue as opposed to code blue. It's a light blue. It's a light blue. Not quite a deep navy blue, but more like a light blue code. A show code, just for show. Slow code is a common, or Hollywood code, to indicate that there is less than aggressive efforts. So, for example, if the norm is to compress the chest about 1.5 to 2 inches during resuscitative efforts, so perhaps not deeply compressing the chest, maybe 1/2 inch, 3/4 inch. Something like that. Or instead of giving perhaps all of the medications pharmacologically that might be indicated based on the arrhythmias that the patient is experiencing, not to give all of them. Maybe give lower doses, not sometimes to intubate, to be a little bit slow, call the code a little bit sooner. That's slow code. So what is the basis of slow code? So I want to make at the outset that in general, when a slow code, I don't know if anyone here has either participated in or observed a slow code, I really don't want to go on too long. I really want to try to get to some of the basics and really conclude and give you the opportunity for the last word and any experiences that you've had in the slow code. So we're going to try to conclude this in about the time that a normal code might run, about 20 minutes, let's say, if it's a full 20-minute code or so. We'll try to be done with this in this period of time. If I go over, please pull the plug. I'm sorry. I'm trying to get back into my rabbinic mode when I go back to my community, so you'll pardon me. But nonetheless, the notion of a slow code at the outset is not to be viewed in the sense of judgmental about the individuals who may be involved. Because probably more often than not, if not pervasively, the mindset of the residents, of the clinicians, of the attendings, of the nursing staff, whoever it may be that's involved, has a certain degree of validity, certainly a sincerity, meaning that it's done for reasons that they feel are justified in not aggressively or what is considered to be traditionally providing resuscitative efforts in terms of cardiopulmonary resuscitation. So even though, for example, in another article, they talk about the fact that it is humanely motivated, but it is, as some suggest, a humanely motivated lie or deception. But it is humanely motivated. There's a wonderful, very, very concise work on general bioethics written by Dr. Mark Siegler from Chicago, forget the co-author with him, but Mark Siegler, the very renowned bioethicist, a Jewish fellow, had the pleasure of speaking to him once by phone, very friendly, very nice. Dr. Mark Siegler in Chicago, I think he's at University of Chicago, Pritzker. So he's an internist, I think, by training, and he's a renowned clinical ethicist. So in his book called Clinical Ethics, they talk about indications and contraindications for CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation. So they have a section about partial codes or slow codes. I'd just like to read a little bit to you. The terms slow code describe a subterfuge in which doctors and nurses respond slowly to a cardiac arrest and perform CPR without energy or enthusiasm, simply to show the family that something is being done. Usually this is done in two circumstances. Number one, when the medical team feels that the resuscitation would be futile, and that's a concept that I do want to expand upon in a moment, that where the resuscitation would be futile, but no discussion has taken place with the patient or the family. That's also an important point. And just to put that aside as perhaps one of the most important points, one of the most important things, which certainly has been espoused, I think, during the course of this conference, is the need for communication. And that it is, if you look at some of the vignettes, one of the vignettes at least, that Ms. I think Sullivan in her article that I included talks about with one of her grandfathers, is that there was no communication before the time that her grandfather coded between the medical team and the family. Without a communication, then certainly things can, you know, whenever there's communication, it always tends to either address the issue directly or at least relieve some of the tensions within the issue. So there needs to be communication between medical team and family, medical team and patient, medical team and family if the family is the, if you will, the surrogate or the proxy, but medical team and patient or whoever is making the decisions, that's a different discussion. So that's important. And with that communication, some of these issues can certainly be resolved. I also want to make mention of the fact that it is not uncommon that Jewish families who think in particular, and there are some poskim who subscribe to this notion. I do not personally subscribe to it, though it does have validity. And that is that there is an opinion practiced within the Jewish community in some families and supported by some poskim that a patient should never be made a DNR. Not because the patient really should be resuscitated, but because of the concern that when you write and label a patient as a DNR, that will compromise the rest or portions of the rest of the care. Now, the truth of the matter is that does happen sometimes, and there's support for that in the general literature, not only in halachic literature. There is support. I think it needs a little bit more working out, and there is. And I have observed it. On occasion. I don't believe personally that that's the overwhelming pervasive approach, but that can happen. It requires to obviate that. I don't think the answer is to not implement a DNR. The front is to communicate and to have advocates. Every patient needs an advocate. In Maimonides Medical Center, where I did my internship, they have a whole department called patient advocates, which when I was there certainly did wonderful work. So everyone needs an advocate, but that's why important for family to be there and to advocate on part of the patient. So that's in that kind of situation, one could argue that if the family really wants the patient to not be resuscitated, but they are concerned about instituting such a formal order because of implications either consciously or subconsciously on the part of the staff with respect to the rest of the care of the patient, because a DNR is just that, do not resuscitate. It has nothing to do with any other modality of treatment necessarily. And as a result, in fact, I remember as a student back in Detroit that there was once a patient, I think it was a DNR, and for some reason the person had a history of seizure activity and had a seizure during the course of their, I think, dying experience because there was never an order to put in the anti-seizure medication. That's not, in my opinion, medically and halakhically and ethically justifiable. The patient is a DNR. Patient's DNR. There's no reason the patient should have to suffer a seizure before they die if it's preventable. That's a different thing. So there is validity to the notion, but I think the answer to the notion is not to just blanketly and categorically not implement DNRs. The answer is to have proper communication, proper advocacy on behalf of patients, make things clear. But one could argue that might be a very small window of justification for implementing this concept of slow code, where the patient does not have a DNR, but somehow there's some communication either at the time of the code or otherwise that, well, we really would want the patient to just be left alone, but we didn't want to introduce a DNR because of our concerns about perhaps modifying and compromising general care. So therefore, maybe that would be a situation. But even then, I don't think it would really be justified halakhically or ethically. Even either one does it or one doesn't do it. If not, then the family should give the order then at the time of the cardiovascular collapse or the arrest, not to do it anymore, not to do it at that time. So Dr. Siegler writes that when the medical team feels the resuscitation would be futile, but no discussion has taken place. When you talk about futility is a difficult concept. Futility is an English word, but in medicine and in bioethics, futility is not a simple concept. And there are different categories of futility, and one has to try as much as possible to precisely define what form of futility one is talking about. So, for example, one can talk about what's known as quantitative or physiologic futility. That means that the patient has coded about half an hour ago and about 15 minutes ago. We resuscitate him, then they code it again. So coding, resuscitating the patient after they've already coded within the past hour or two twice, that's physiologically futile, meaning that the intended purpose physiologically of the treatment will not achieve its intended purpose. Very restricted definition of futility, physiological or quantitative futility, where the goal, like giving a person with certain forms of metastatic cancer, certain forms of chemotherapy, where we know medically it will be futile in terms of achieving its intended physiologic purpose. That's physiologic. So there are situations in which resuscitative efforts will be futile in terms of accomplishing. The person will not be resuscitated, or even if they are, it will be for 5 minutes, and they're going to code again in another 5 minutes or so. So that's physiologic. That's what they're talking about. Medically futile means futile physiologically, quantitatively. And that's a situation where a DNR certainly is appropriate halakhically, ethically, and morally. Very few. There are some who I think might take issue with that halakhically. I think very few would propose that a patient in whom resuscitative efforts would be physiologically futile should still be resuscitated. I think there might be some post-chem who would still support that, but the overwhelming majority would certainly not support implementing CPR in those cases. Number two, when the family has chosen resuscitation and the team feels it would be useless, clinical experience suggests that patients rarely, if ever, are successfully resuscitated by slow code. That makes sense. A slow code is dishonest, crass dissimulation, and unethical. So I just want to come back to futility for a moment, because it is a different form of futility that oftentimes motivates humanely and sincerely a healthcare team to provide a slow code. And the notion being not physiologic futility or quantitative, but qualitative futility. Qualitative futility means that we can resuscitate this patient, the patient will be resuscitated, and the patient will continue to live for days, weeks, months, maybe, for extended periods of time. However, qualitatively, in terms of quality of life, Dr. Eisenberg talked about quality of life in the previous session here, I think, this side of the room, previously, and noted that there is a basis in halacha for quality of life, and I think he's absolutely correct. One finds the notion of eichut hachayim, quality of life, is something that the poskim do support with, again, appropriate parameters. So qualitative futility means that the team feels that even if we resuscitate the patient successfully, which we can do, and the patient continues to live for an extended period of time, which oftentimes will happen, what benefit, what, if you will, tova, have you done for the patient? Because if the patient is in end-stage Alzheimer's dementia, for example, and before the person coded, the person had no awareness of his or her environment, had no communication, was not eating on his or her own, has a feeding tube. So that the quality of life is such that what are you accomplishing? What benefit? Yes, physiologically we can restore the heartbeat, and we can certainly restore the breathing, or at least provide mechanical ventilation, but what quality of life benefit will there be to a patient? Now, one has to assess in that case what was the baseline, what's the prognosis for that baseline improving, and if the baseline is of tremendous compromise in quality of life and there's no prognosis, like an end-stage Alzheimer's dementia as an example, then what is the benefit being provided? And that is oftentimes the motivation for a slow code, because they feel there is no benefit. And there is certainly, the idea has a certain justifiable notion to it. The question is, though, and that's what I want to address in my remaining time, is it justifiable, though, that when either there was no discussion about DNR, and therefore the default is resuscitate, or there was a discussion and the family, for whatever reasons, still wanted all aggressive treatments to be provided, including resuscitative efforts, in spite of the fact that the family member is end stage whatever, that they still want it, and that's what the family wants. And that's more than that. Let's make it more poignant. That's what the patient wants. The patient expressed it explicitly when they were still able to do so, either just before the code or sometime previously or prior or remotely in some form. They expressly, the family knows their wishes. They express their wishes. We have no question about the patient's wishes. But the clinical team feels that they're not only not providing any benefit for the patient, they even feel that sometimes they're providing a disservice to the patient, that they're providing, if you will, in the last moments of the person's life, an indignation. They're not providing them proper cover, proper respect, because they're pumping on the chest and they're doing all of this, and it's supposed to let the patient just kind of, if you will, peacefully pass away. And perhaps if they are successful, the patient will linger on in a state of perhaps some kind of, again, compromised quality of life, perhaps even, depending on the effects and success of the resuscitative efforts, maybe even linger with some discomfort and pain. So they feel not only is it futile, it may even be harmful, which, again, Dr. Steinberg, all through this conference, I have to pause for a moment, all through this conference we've been referring to each other as Rabbi Doctor, Dr. Rabbi, Dr. Rabbi. So the truth is, I remember when I rotated in Maimonides with Dr. Miller, so Dr. Miller, a neurologist, was at Maimonides, now he's in Manhattan, separate. So Dr. Miller used to taught us that, in neurology at least, when you address a patient who perhaps is not fully oriented, the best way to address the patient, respectfully of course, is by using their first name. Because patients tend to be more responsive cognitively to their first name than to their last. So instead of saying to the patient, Mr. Rabbi Dr. Weiss, you say Richard. And that's more likely to elicit a response from a patient who perhaps is not fully oriented. So, but out of respect, we refer to each other. But in a sense, there is a certain, if you will, chadivut, endearment, as well as perhaps eliciting by referring to somebody by their first name, but not in this setting. So Rabbi Dr. Steinberg, I think, was referring to the four basic principles of bioethics of autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice. So in a sense, they feel that when there's no benefit to this patient, and if anything, they're violating the principle of non-maleficence, that they're actually harming the patient. So there is a basis for this notion of a slow code. The question is it justified ethically or, for our purposes, and that's what I'll focus on for remaining of my time, halakhically? Because the literature, to the extent that it exists, it certainly, as I just mentioned, considers it a lie, considers it deception, considers it a subterfuge, and therefore it's basically just trying to, if you will, satisfy the fact that the patient was not a DNR and satisfy perhaps the family's view that something was done, but not do what they think ethically would be harmful or certainly not beneficial to the patient. So halakhically, what is the issue? So with that, I'd just like to focus on three particular aspects of the halakhic issue. Number one is the notion of deception, which in halakha is known as genevas das, that I'm fool somebody. I'm, if you will, mislead them, either actively or perhaps sometimes passively, making them think that I am either doing something beneficial for them or that I am representing something that is really X, and I'm representing it as Y. So, for example, Dr. Abraham, in his work, Nishmas Avram, who was mentioned a while ago, the two best contemporary works on bioethics, the best work in bioethics, I think, was still authored by Rabbi Dr. Lord Emanuel Jacobowitz when he wrote his PhD thesis in the 1950s, Father of Jewish Bioethics. If you don't have the book, that's a must book, because it was written in the 50s, it was modified, I think, in the 70s, and it's still so relevant. So many of his principles and ideas are just kind of, he was ahead of his time, no question. But that's in English, but the best works contemporary-wise, in Hebrew, and they've all been translated into English, are by Dr. Abraham, You can call him Abraham. Dr. Abraham S. Abraham, very, very big Talmud Chacham. I've had the pleasure of speaking to him many times on the phone. He was a former, I think, associate director of internal medicine at Shaar HaTzedek Hospital, where Dr. Steinberg is a pediatric neurologist. So he wrote many works, but the most impressive is Nishmas Avram, which he's just republished within the past couple of years in the more expanded version. So every simon in Shulchan Aruch and every sif that has anything to do with medical ethics, he has the simon and the sif and the discussion, the Chavar Amah, and on the bottom he has extensive literature, quoting from all kinds of Sfarim, Rishonim, Achronim, and contemporary, Rav Eliyahu, Shlomo Zalman, all of that. And then the other classic work, which for which Dr. Rabbi Dexter Steinberg won the Israel Prize, was As Gerald mentioned, Dr. Friedman mentioned at the beginning, he won the Israel Prizes for his Encyclopedia Halachatit Rifuit, Encyclopedia of Jewish Medical Ethics, which was translated by Dr. Rosner. So those are just extensive works of Dr. Abraham. In his work, he quotes from the Carlina Rav of Kilos Yaakov the following question about a young man who suffered from testicular cancer. So he had, in this case, he had his left testicle removed. It was excised. So the whole discussion in Shulchan Aruch regarding the definition of Suadaka and Krushavcha, what constitutes a situation in which a man with certain anatomical defects in terms of some of his reproductive organs is also Lavo Bakahal, is not permitted to marry, at least not permitted to marry a regular, if you will, a regular, meaning a kind of conventional Bas Yisrael, maybe certain other types of individuals who perhaps have also their own anatomical normalities, he may be permitted. I'm not familiar with all the specifics. So in Shulchan Aruch, it's discussed in Simen Hay in Eben Hoezer, when yes and when not. So there is an opinion that if a man had one testis removed, and still has one intact, that he is not prohibited to marry anyone. There's no specific prohibition. Others say not. So based on that, the Kilos Yaakov was asked about such an individual, a man who had one of his testes, his left one, excised because of, let's say, cancer, relying on the opinion that he's permitted to marry any woman he wishes. One of the questions asked to him was, is he obligated to disclose that information to her before they get married? Is he obligated to inform her and disclose that he had testicular cancer and one of his testes was excised? And this is so that she shouldn't be under the assumption, because generally a woman would be under the assumption, unless otherwise indicated, that the man she's marrying does not have any anatomical defects in general of any significance, certainly not reproductively. So would he be obligated to disclose that information? Would it be considered geneva's das, deception on his part, by not informing her? So the Gilas Yaakov quotes, and Dr. Abraham quotes, the Shlomo Zalman concurs with this idea, that for a complicated discussion that he has, but one aspect of it we want to focus on, that he thinks that it would not be required for this young man to disclose this to the woman. Now there's a separate discussion one can have, which we're not going to have, about whether or not that's something that may in the end compromise their relationship because of trust issues. There's one aspect of halachic, whether a person's deceiving. The other question is whether the person's going to score any points with trust if she eventually does find out, which is probably going to happen because presumably he has to go for follow-up if he had testicular cancer to make sure that whatever else has happened and had not, and presumably she may find out what kind of issue and compromise and trust relationship. That's a different question. That's for Dr. Michelle Friedman to answer. But nonetheless, that's a separate. But halachically, he felt that he is not obligated to disclose it. And one of the reasons that he gives is the following. He says that this man is not actively deceiving her. He's not telling her, you know what, I have no health problems, I have nothing at all, I'm a perfect specimen of health. And then he loses, then he gets short of breath as he runs down the aisle. But he is not any compromise in health. So that would be actively deceiving. That, he says, would not be permissible. But here he is, in a sense, passively deceiving. He's not providing information. If she asks him, that's one thing. But she didn't even think about asking. Why should she even entertain it? Although, and this is a definite ethical issue, which I'm not quite sure exactly how to address totally. I try to do it, but I, as a rabbi in a community, oftentimes get calls from shadchanim or family members with whom they're setting up some kind of shidduch with someone in my community. And one of the standard questions that's asked, either because they know something or they don't know something, is does the person have any health issues? Does the family have any health issues? So first of all, I personally think that that's a totally inappropriate question to ask. Number one, medical information is private, confidential information of whoever it may be. I don't have the right to ask about, does somebody have normal blood pressure? I can't ask, did they have their immunizations? So that's medical information. That's confidential information. Confidentiality is a Jewish principle. Chavetz Chaim talks about it. And Shmiras HaLashon, he talks about it. It's a small discussion about confidentiality and privacy issues. So to ask him about that without having authorization of it, either to ask or for me to disclose it. And presumably, generally speaking, I'm not given, whether they know someone's calling me or not, that Rabbi, you can discuss whatever you want about our health situation. Of course people don't do that, whether there is anything or not. So I think it's an inappropriate question, but it's a very common question, and I think it's inappropriate. How I address it is a different question, but nonetheless, the person is not actively, in this case, deceiving her. He's simply not providing information. So Eino Ella, so he feels, Kilos Yaakov, the Karlina Rav, that the Isser Shel Ganeva's Das is Hainu Shlom around the parish. He's not explicitly, actively deceiving her. Rak Sheinu Misafer Chesronotav. He's just not disclosing all of his deficiencies. So that he feels is Ganeva's Das Midrabbanan, on a rabbinic level, not on a biblical level. Therefore, what? So it's still prohibited. So he says, yes, ubamokom cheshash bitul piriyah v'rivya, usha'ar mechsholos lo gozer chachamim. But if this is going to impede his ability to get married and have children and have a family, or other significant concerns, maybe that gzeira mirabana, that rabbinic injunction against not passively deceiving someone, maybe that can be lifted. So, and he says, "V'shamati megon shalom uzal le'orabach zatzal shigam le'dato ein tzorich le'bachor le'saper le'mishudechet shalom al hanituach shavara," on the past previous surgery that he had. So the question that one can raise, therefore, is in a case of shalom kod, is that considered to be deceptive gnevas das halachically? So the answer, I think, would be it depends on how it's done. If the team says to the family, we're going to do everything we can, and we had a discussion, and you want us to resuscitate, and then we do this, so that would perhaps be active deception. If the family is right there when the patient codes, and they say, please go out of the room, and we're going to code the patient, that's active deception. If the family is not necessarily there at the time, and the healthcare team didn't necessarily explicitly say we're going to do it, it's just there's a default that the patient must be resuscitated. And they didn't, in a sense, go out of their way to demonstrate to the family, nobody's there of the patient's coding. It's only the healthcare team. So the middle of the night, no one else is there. They come, so they're not deceiving anyone actively, I would think. They're simply not providing the full resuscitative efforts. And therefore, the family might assume, after the fact, that the patient was resuscitated, or what efforts were made, and they died. If the resident or house officer or attending calls up the family afterwards and said, we did all we can, that would be active deception. It says that your family member died just now. Without going into details, that might be passive. So passive or active, it's still us. It's either biblical, minotaur, it's midrabban, or rabbinic. Unless the healthcare team makes the determination, whether they have the right to do so, make that decision, is a different question I'm not going to address, but they make the determination that there's no benefit to the patient. There's only detriment to the patient by trying to code. It's undignified. It's going to cause them more suffering, whatever it may be, if they make those calculations. So you could argue in that situation, maybe the rabbinic restriction against deceiving passively may not apply. One could make such an argument. The second issue regarding the... let me go to the third issue. I'm going to skip the second one. If it comes up in discussion, fine. Let me go to the third one, which will be the second one for our purposes, and the last one, then I'll close. Is the issue of the fact that if a team provides a slow code, so they are doing something to the patient. They're doing some compression. They're doing some manipulation. If their modus operandi is that the patient is dead and should be left as such, then they are, in a sense, without perhaps realizing it, demonstrating lack of respect for the dead person. They may want to show proper respect to the living person and not subject them to more suffering. But from a halakhic point of view, that is a form of perhaps nivul hames, of disgracing the body. If the patient should not be resuscitated, so whether I do 1.5, 2-inch compressions or whether I just do, even if you do a 1-inch or 3/4, depending on the patient, you can still crack their ribs sometimes. That would be totally disrespectful to the mace. Or doing other procedures. If the patient should not be resuscitated at all, any form of resuscitation, in a sense, is, from a halakhic view, a lack of kibud hames, of honor and respect to the deceased, and it is perhaps even nivul hames, even more active disgracefulness. So if the person should not be, and the person is dead, then the person was dead already at the time they coded, and since you did not resuscitate, then he was dead from the time that he clearly coded, not from the time the resuscitative efforts failed. So then, as were then, the person has been disgracefully treated after they were dead. And that lack of kivud hames, or potential nivul hames, means that even a slow code would be inappropriate because of that perspective. So that either you do a full code or you do no code, and if you can't do a no code, then, and you didn't have the communication beforehand, then it seems that to do a full code for at least the possibility of resuscitating, which may or may not have a benefit for the patient, maybe it will or it won't, but unless there was clear enough that the patient wanted, so then that certainly is an issue because of nivul hames. To conclude, one of the important reasons and clashes in medical ethics regarding this is what was discussed previously as well, and that a notion of autonomy. Because in bioethics, the number one principle in bioethics is autonomy and self-determination. So if a patient explicitly wishes to have resuscitative efforts done, and the healthcare team opposes that, that's in contrast, in conflict, with the number one principle in general bioethics of autonomy and self-determination. So that's why there's a conflict. So justified because of the futility, the qualitative futility, and all of that, but that's a question. But from a halakhic perspective, that autonomy is also important, but also the fact that there may be an element of nevastas, maybe active, maybe passive, maybe justified in some cases, but perhaps that decision should be made more so autonomously by the patient and the family rather than by the healthcare team. Thank you very much. Is there any...
I think
if the patient coded, that means their heart stopped, they're not breathing. So if you leave them alone, that means from that moment when they coded and the code blue was called, they were dead. If you aggressively provide resuscitative efforts and they don't respond, there's no success, so presumably we would assume halakhically the person was dead from the time that the person coded, although legally it's from the time the code is called rather than from the time the code was requested. Perhaps if you restored some degree of heartbeat or pulse and rhythm and then it stopped again, one could try to determine when the time is. But certainly if you're providing less than potentially successful efforts in resuscitation, then clearly the patient has already died. So it's already beyond the point of gosase. So then the question still is, perhaps not hastening their death, but not properly giving respect to a person who has died, who now deserves full respect and should be properly handled as such and not be manipulated or handled in any way that certainly is not to their benefit. Yes?
Do you think that some sort of psychological issue may be operative here? That the team thinks, well, we'll try and it's good once the person is alive and not survive.
So when you start to ask the question, I thought you were going to suggest, so I'll come back to your point, that may be psychological to the family, meaning there is a suggestion in the literature, I don't know that it's in the article I included, but there is a suggestion that sometimes families have difficulty making that decision. It is a difficult decision to implement a DNR for a variety of reasons. Sometimes there's a certain association with guilt, whatever it may be. So sometimes the family just can't make that decision. So the argument is that we do a little bit of something just to kind of psychologically support the family, but we know from our discussions with the family, implicitly, whatever, that really this is not what they would want, not what the patient wanted, or we feel that it's, you know, not appropriate. So we do it kind of to psychologically support the family so the family can feel perhaps less guilt-ridden, less concerned about whether everything was done or not, so perhaps it has some kind of psychological benefit to the family, where there may or may not be. I believe you're a psychiatrist, so maybe there's justification for that. In terms of your specific question or point about the notion of providing a slow code and then kind of saying that if you will, if it was the divine will that it should be effective. So I think the answer to that is, I mean, Dr. Siegler uses an interesting phrase. He says that slow codes rarely, if ever. I think the answer probably is if ever. I don't think rarely. I don't think they ever are successful unless you know you just do a cardiac thump and they transmit some jewels across their chest wall and they resuscitate like that. But that's not the usual situation. That, in a sense, then we're relying on what was discussed previously about that Ein Sompin, in a sense, maybe not Alanais exactly, but if we are obligated to treat, then we don't rely on, if you will, God intervening and doing everything for us. We have to do everything which is conventional or medically indicated to do so, with the hope that God will help us in this normative process. But if we're not providing normative or conventional treatment for this particular, then we're kind of relying solely on God, on a nais, on a miracle, and that's not the normal philosophy or theology of Judaism. Yes,
Dr. I think sometimes appropriately, and that is the situation which I think does exist, and that is that when someone is made DNR, the quality of care does change, and the nursing changes, and the house staff attitude changes, the idea of giving antibiotics and even blood products, doing things which are halakhically required sometimes fall off, and therefore to indicate DNR compromise the quality of care. But nonetheless, the hospital and the house staff have a legal requirement to do resuscitation if the DNR is not signed. And this is a situation, I think, where it comes up and it may in fact be appropriate. I mean, the problem is that you're doing either that nipple MS may be occurring or interfering with the GOSES, but I think that you have to look, that we have an imperfect system that we. At least in my opinion, it's often difficult to sign the DNR, and you have to decide which is more important, taking care of the patient properly in the hospital or doing this less than perfect slow code. And I think that maybe, I don't hear your opinion, that choosing the slow code might be the better choice.
So kind of just to ask you a question in response, how would that decision to implement a slow code versus a full code be communicated? Who knows, whose decision would it be? In other words, if somehow there's some kind of private communication between attending and family, who's a long-standing relationship. The attending says, you know what, let's not introduce a DNR because I'm concerned about the care, but at the time, I'll make sure that it's a slow code. So if it's communicated as such in some way that it can be, but the problem is, though, isn't it that if everyone knows it's going to be a slow code, then by definition it kind of defeats the purpose because everyone knows that we're not going to really code. The only way to do is if no one knows that it's going to be a slow code, and who's going to make that decision? How's it going to be communicated?
If the DNR is written in the chart, then it becomes like an official statement.
So you don't write the DNR.
Right.
So then who makes the decision at what time, or how is it
communicated? What happens is, you're seeing the patient on a daily basis, and you see that things are winding down, and you talk to the house staff, and you tell them that if this happens, and it may not be perfect, it may be that they'll do a full code. Mm-hmm. You try to minimize the nivola mass will be, or
So, I mean, I think that can work when you have, let's say, example, an attending who has a long-standing relationship with the family, and there's trust there, and therefore they can, you know, do that, and the attending can kind of organize and orchestrate and direct the house staff. But that it, right, in that kind of situation, maybe it would be in a situation where it's kind of a controlled environment.
I think we're going to wrap the session.
Okay, I'll happily take private questions.
Yeah, we're going to close the session now. People have travel plans, and we're just a few minutes late, and I want to stick to the schedule as much as possible. I'd like to thank Dr. Weiss for, again, a great talk, and thank all the speakers in absentia.